Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
A very good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, brought to you as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio and listened to around the world as a podcast. And wherever you are, however you're listening, thank you for choosing the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for conversations that matter. Got a really interesting, exciting, fun edition of the programme for you today. Before we get into it, though, just a brief word to say this episode of the show is dedicated to the memory of Michael Green, who passed away this last week. He was well known as an evangelist and an apologist. He spoke at Unbelievable, the conference 2012. He had a long-time ministry based out of Oxford University, with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, the Ochre and Wycliffe Hall, and indeed was instrumental in my own parents' conversion in their student days at Oxford University. So will be much missed, but leaves an enormous legacy of gospel ministry and changed lives. So in honour of him, may he rest in peace and rise in glory. Michael Green passed away this last week, I think at the age of about 89. What a remarkable life. We're going to be hearing your feedback, of course, to last week's show, where we had another extraordinary individual join us too, in fact, John Lennox and Peter Atkins, for that live student debate. Going to be hearing some of your thoughts on that. It was a barnstormer of a show. And we also had a lot of feedback to the one before that, when Raymond Tallis and David Bentley Hart shared their thoughts on logos, mind, consciousness, and that kind of thing. So that was an interesting one. We'll hear what you made of that. Don't forget, you can check out loads of our content as well in video format at the YouTube channel, including that John Lennox and Peter Atkins debate, which has been proving very popular. Lots of views coming in for that. Links from the Unbelievable show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can also find links to the podcast, features, the app, the newsletter, the DVD, and of course Unbelievable, the book as well. Signed copies available if you click through to the to where you can get them from Premier. We are going to be releasing soon the ticketing details for Unbelievable, the conference 2019, and releasing the full speaker list. Very excited about who's joining us for the conference this year. It's happening on Saturday, the 20th of July. Put that in your diary. Central London, Westminster Central Hall will be our venue, and we'll be talking all about it very soon. For now, let's get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, I'm really looking forward to today's show. James Carey, BBC sitcom writer and theologian, joins me, along with Katie Brand. They are fellow comedians, and James has a new book out called The Sacred Art of Joking, or Why Jokes So Often Go Horribly Wrong. It opens up the pitfalls of comedy and religion in the modern world. And Katie Brand, who starred in various TV shows and soon set to be involved in a BBC production called The Pilgrimage, also joins us on the show today. Katie actually became a Christian in her teenage years, but lost her faith at university, as told in her stand-up show, I Was a Teenage Christian. So we're going to be talking about finding and losing faith in the comedy world and where the boundary lies between poking fun and provoking offence. So Katie and James, welcome along to the programme today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. It's great to have you.
Thank you, James. You're in studio with me, Katie on the line. Let's just get a little background to you both, first of all, though. James, comedy and faith, have they always kind of gone together for you?
They have for me, because I've always loved jokes. I've always loved comedy. I only ever wanted to watch comedy on the television when I was growing up. And I just wanted comedians, comedy, two Ronnies, sitcoms, everything. And I went to a very Christian school and became a Christian through the school from the age of about 9 or 10. And so I spent spent a lot of time enjoying these two things, which often didn't seem to go together terribly well, because the Christian faith stuff was relatively serious and then the comedy stuff was often quite irreverent. And those were the days when you also had Dave Allen on the TV dressing up as the Pope and doing a striptease on the on the front of an ecclesiastical building. So the two never seemed to quite go together, but at the same time, I didn't feel like I was living in two completely different worlds. But then I sort of then developed a career as a comedy writer, but because I've retained my Christian faith and I still am, I'm happy to be a Christian, I've sort of wanted to do something which brings these two things together and sort of overlaps the two worlds that I live in, because I'm a bit of a weirdo in the comedy world. I'm the weirdo that still goes to church.
Right.
And in the church world, I'm the weirdo who works for the BBC.
Just for those who may not recognise your names, your name from the credits of some of these shows, just tell us some of the programmes that you do work on and write stuff for.
Virtually no one will recognise my name. So, I did a lot of comedy for Radio 4. I did a show called Think the Unthinkable and another sitcom called Hut 33. And then I also worked on Miranda's show, so series 1 and 2 of Miranda. And then I did a show called Bluestone 4-2 for BBC Three about bomb disposal in Afghanistan. And I also write Milton Jones's radio show with him. And I wrote episodes of My Hero sort of 10, 15 years ago as well with Ardlo Hanlon and a bit of My Family as well. So half-hour sitcom is kind of my thing that I've really liked.
You tend to be more on the writing side, though, than the kind of upfront side.
Very much so, yeah.
And in the book, obviously, you talk, you know, about all kinds of different aspects of comedy. But when it comes to Christians in the comedy world, are you a rare breed, would you say?
Fairly rare, because the Christians who do work in the British comedy scene, we do sort of all know each other. Occasionally someone surprises us by outing themselves as a Christian. But overall, it's not it's not something that is widely a common thing.
I mean, and that's, one or two of the people you mentioned I happen to know do have a Christian faith. Milton Jones, Miranda, and you've got people like Tim Vine and others who were kind of regulars on the
that's pretty much all
circuit.
Of them. it's not a long list.
Sally Phillips, I've interviewed as well.
Sally is publicly very Christian, and there are one or two others as well. But overall, we're a pretty small bunch. But having said that, UK nationally, Christians tend to be in a fairly small minority of people who actually regularly go to church. So I suspect it is probably disproportionately not Christian, if you see what I mean. You would expect to find more.
Is there anything about going into the comedy business, in a sense, that stops, in a way, people of faith getting into it? Do they think it's going to be a bit of a hard world to have a faith in?
Well, I never found that. And Katie, I'd be interested in your kind of experience of this. But overall, I would suggest that if somebody, especially if a young bloke, is quite intelligent and articulate and is good with the crowd, they'll tell him to become a vicar or a minister.
That's true,
Don't waste your life in Babylon going to the BBC and laughing people into hell.
I've met many vicars who basically wanted to be stand-up comedians and have used their pulpit as the place to have those dreams
which
met.
Is a disaster. Yeah, no one wants to hear those sermons. But I don't know, Katie, do you find that when you were making your way in sort of comedy or thinking about comedy, even in the teenage years, was it just like that was not a thinkable thing for a Christian to do? I don't know.
I wouldn't say it was unthinkable. I just don't think I didn't reconcile the two parts. A bit like you, I think. So I was a really full-on Christian from the age of 13 to around 19 or 20, and I was going to church 3 or 4 times a week. I was in the worship band. I was on the prayer team. I was on the tea and coffee team, went to the youth group. Like, I was very, very into it. But I also had this love of comedy, and I was watching things on TV and loving comedy and had sort of, you know, and I liked everything from French and Saunders to things that were a bit darker and stranger in the kind of midnight slot on Channel 4 and all that. And then Vic and Bob were huge at that time for the first, you know, the first time round. And so I had quite a wide sort of spectrum of comedy tastes. And I think some of them were probably more acceptable within my church community than others. And it wasn't so much, I wasn't really thinking about having a career in comedy when I was a teenager. I liked performing. I liked showing off. I liked laughing with my friends. I liked writing to some extent, but It was only really when I got to university that I started to think that I could actually have a career in it. And I think that probably dovetailed with me leaving the church, actually. And I really got into comedy at university and got into the groups that were performing and writing comedy at university and did the Edinburgh Festival for the first time when I was 20. And that all just sort of took off. But I don't think it contributed to me leaving the church, but I definitely think that I was on my way out of the church and comedy scooped me up. And right. I started to see that I could make a life there during my faith. It wasn't because I had other ambitions. I wanted to be a chaplain. I wanted to work with prisoners and serious offenders. So I had a kind of number of thoughts about it.
I wanted to ask a little bit, and thanks for filling us in on some of the details, Katie, about your own journey there, because as I read it from some of the interviews I've read, you were sort of the class joker. I wonder if that's often where comedy begins for a lot of people, in terms of being a bit of an extrovert. But this went hand in hand with the fact that you did become a Christian for a time, but you didn't come from a Christian background. So can you kind of just explain slightly what the process was that brought you there? And then again, yeah, what kind of you think it was ultimately that led you out of it?
Yeah, I wasn't from a strong Christian background. I was probably, but I wasn't from a totally atheist background either. I mean, religion had always been in the background of my family, and you know, two of my grandparents were very, very full on Salvation Armyists in their youth, and there was that kind of in the background, and it was all kind of very Church of England, and then I was christened, you know, but we weren't regular churchgoers, except for a slightly confusing period where I went to a Roman Catholic convent school when I was very little, and we did actually engage with we were taught by nuns, and we did go to the church there, but it was very clear, made very clear to me that I was a Protestant child,
right.
And therefore I wasn't allowed to take communion, I wasn't allowed to do the confirmation, and when other children went off to do their confirmation, I had to stay in the classroom on my own and things like that. So it was a kind of, it wasn't ever a kind of, oh, this is my nest, this is where we all are, all my family, you know, and everything was always up for discussion in the house.
Sure.
It wasn't a sort of devout house by any means, let's put it like that. And then we moved away and I went, and then my only real experience of church was probably after that was Brownies, where every so often you had to go to church on a Sunday and carry a flag. And it wasn't really until I was 13, my parents really didn't attend church at all, and I wouldn't say that they necessarily would call themselves Christians. It was when I was 13 and I went to school near a very sort of all-encompassing charismatic evangelical church in a village. And it was a Church of England church. It was a parish church, but it was very much caught up in that movement in the 90s of outreach and the movement of the Spirit and things that I'm sure will be familiar with a lot of evangelicals.
Yeah.
Who are listening. And so some friends of mine, an old family friends, actually started going to this church, and they asked me to go on holiday with them, just as a coincidence. So I went on holiday with them, and we literally spent the whole week talking about God. I'd known them all my life, so they had become Christians, and they were suddenly very into it. So I was quite fascinated by all this. And I'd always been fascinated with the big questions of life, and I like having those sorts of conversations, deep and meaningful, as people used to call it at my church. And so we talked about it for the whole week, really. We spent the whole time in St. Ives, ignoring everything and just talking about God. And so they said, when I got back, come to church with us. Why don't you come and see if you like it? So I went that evening. It was a Sunday evening. And I thought, God, this is very rock and roll church service on a Sunday evening. I've never known anything like it. And it was like that. I went in. It was a big, must have been 1,000 people in the congregation. There was a rock band leading the worship. You know, the vicar did actually do quite a very funny sermon, and there were a number of preachers associated with that church who did have a good sense of humour and could certainly get people laughing, properly laughing, and were very good at telling anecdotes and jokes and so on. And so I just got really swept up in it, really. I promptly fell in love with the worship band leader and made sort of gooey eyes at him, was overwhelmed with the youth group. It became my life. The youth worker was a really great guy, and I just kind of got, it absolutely took over every aspect of my life, really. And I did eventually get into the worship band and so on. And I did loads of stuff, you know, New Wine, Soul Survivor, all of that stuff. You know, it was a kind of annual calendar, really. You always had something to do. And so I took it very, very seriously. But I do remember cracking jokes people didn't like. I remember having sort of naughty little jokes with people as I got older, that I made up my own tongues and things like that, and like it felt kind of off.
Those weren't appropriate sort of things to be joking about.
No, in
a way,
those weren't the right things to be joking about. So there were correct things that we could joke about and laugh about, and people certainly had a good sense of humour, and people could be genuinely funny. But if you tipped it too far, or it became too satirical, or a bit dark, or a bit strange, or too irreverent, then you felt a chill wind. Mm,
I have a feeling that you and I are probably a similar sort of age, Katie, and grew up in very similar sorts of Christian circles. I'm 39, so there. Mm. but the point being that you know, the things you're referencing, Soul Survivor, I think in your stage show you blast out a Delirious song at the end. These are all cultural references that I'm very familiar with, as having grown up as a teenager in the mid-90s.
Things like Greenbelt, you know, we weren't supposed to go to Greenbelt. And I always think these fine distinctions, which actually we should talk about later. I thought they did brilliantly in Rev, absolutely brilliantly in Rev. But, and I thought, I must be one of a very small number of people in this country who get a joke about Greenbelt being not appropriate.
It is frustrating when you're in those two different worlds and you suddenly see a link between the two of them. I remember at one point I spotted, there's a Christian preacher called John Piper. And quite a long time ago, I spotted that he looks quite a lot like Larry David, but I didn't know anyone who knew who both of those people were until eventually, about a year later, I made this observation, and they went, "Yes!" And I was like, "Hooray!" I sort of hugged them.
If you were in an American church, you might who John Piper is.
Maybe
and Larry
a bit
David.
More like,
I
left the church eventually. Sort of, I started to fall away. I did GCSE RE and they weren't very keen on that. And I did A-level RE and they weren't very keen on that. And then I decided I would do a theology degree at what they would call a secular university, and was strongly advised that I ought to go to Bible college or I'd lose my faith. And damn them, they were right. But I think I started to move away mentally because I found it difficult. But in my particular church, and this isn't all Christians by any means, but in my particular church, there was a massive discomfort with academic study of the Bible.
Right.
And kind of scrutinizing everything historically and academically, and I started being dropped from the various groups. You know, I couldn't get anywhere near the worship band after that sort of thing.
Right.
And eventually the one of the church leaders started a petition to ban Harry Potter, which I flatly refused to sign. And I think by that point I had really had enough, and I was on my way to university. And I did stay. I attended church for the first year or so of university, but it just felt more and more distant from me. And the more I got involved with comedy and theatre and stuff at university, it just felt like I felt to some extent they weren't mad about having me back. And I wasn't really that keen on going back either. So it just felt like, okay, well, anyway, you know, see ya. And I carried on my merry way.
Yeah.
And here I am now.
I mean, we'll get into some of the ins and outs of the other parts of our conversation shortly. But James, what's your response to that kind of a story, which to me is saddening that the church, we won't name names here, but that Katie attended, didn't like the idea of academically opening up the scripture.
It's not uncommon. And I think there are certain forms of the Christian faith where they are terrified of academia. And actually, I mean, I'd studied theology at the University of Durham. It was a secular theology degree. I didn't have my faith smashed to pieces at all. If anything, it was sort of bolstered, actually, in some ways. So it is always, to me, a bit of a shame. But again, it goes back a little bit to the overall thing, which I think is the reason why churches are unhappy with comedy, is because churches, like most large institutions, they like control. And what comedy does is comedy is anarchic. It rings your doorbell and runs, and it pokes you, it taps you on the wrong shoulder. The people I'm always worried about are people who say, "Oh yes, we love humour." Nobody who actually likes jokes says how much they love humour.
Men who say, "I love the company of women."
Yes.
Think, well, okay.
Yes, the company of women. What does
that
mean?
Until they're your boss, I think you probably love the company of women, and then it's a rather different story.
Yes, some of my best friends are .. But
yes,
it's more
exactly.
But because comedy requires a certain robustness to be able to explore things and to say things that shouldn't be said, or say things that you know not to be true, but that they are they're a joke. Mm. So we all know they're not true.
Or just to add to that, things you know perfectly well to be true, but other people don't necessarily want to acknowledge it.
Yes.
I think that's another danger of comedy, is kind of, it can shine quite an unforgiving light on things that perhaps people would rather not address.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that can be the other side to it, is that, yes, there's a kind of hyperbole, exaggeration, you know, the sort of side of it, but then the other side is just the clear-eyed comedian who can just zero in on something and then expose it. And I think that sometimes is a problem as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it does strike me that very often, inevitably, comedians of all professions constantly get quoted out of context by simply people taking their words and putting them out of the context of the show they were being delivered in, and then you can say, oh, Russell Brand says that, blah 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 blah, and obviously anyone who knows what Russell Brand's like knows that he's gonna have said that entirely with his tongue in his cheek, but it's the nature of that, where
it's like, well, it's like when we say, well, Shakespeare, I mean, I think I mentioned it in the book, where Shakespeare said this, that, or the other. No, Shakespeare didn't say anything. Macbeth may have said what you just said, or Hamlet may have said what you just said. I wouldn't take life advice off that King of Denmark. Don't, it's a character in a fictional world, so people do strip context out. And I often say, I think I've written it in the book somewhere, one of the least funny things in it that's possible is when a presenter of Newsnight reads out a joke to a comedian who said it in front of a member of a lobby group who are obviously professionally offended by what this comedian has just said, and sort of says, so in your set you said bum 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 bum, is that funny? And you go, well, you kind of had to be there. It's not funny when when you do
Kirsty Walk. It's not funny. It's not funny when you say it. Exactly.
It was hilarious at 11 o'clock at night at Jongleurs.
I mean, your own book, James, starts off with a little tale recounting an interview you did with Ben Elton. This was several years ago now, but you were writing it up for a Christian magazine at the time. But in fact, to your surprise, it got picked up by a lot of national media outlets in the end. Do you want to just tell us the story and how this leads into the subjects that you cover in the book?
Well, yes. Well, very briefly, I did an interview for Third Way magazine with Ben Elton, who was obviously a comedy hero of mine because he co-wrote three series of Blackadder. And he's a, you know, he is a giant in comedy. So I interviewed Ben Elton for a Christian magazine that I was writing for, and they sent me along to interview this guy. I'm not a journalist, so why they got me to do it, I don't know. But because I was a sitcom writer, I guess. Talked to one of my heroes, and in the course of this interview, he said that that when they were shooting a sitcom, I think it was The Right Way, actually, which was not a well-liked sitcom. I think he had a phrase, Muhammad coming to the mountain. And they just said, I'll just cut that. And he said, oh, you know, for goodness sake, you know, the BBC must be afraid of Islam. And that and he said he had some sympathy with Christians who thought that the BBC was a little bit too scared of Islam and a bit too much against Christianity. Mm-hmm. And we moved on very quickly. And neither of us thought what he said was a controversial statement, to the point where it was published. And then suddenly there was a Times newspaper story about this. And, you know, my 2G mobile phone started ringing. This is all pre-Twitter as well, I think. And suddenly it was a story. And I was on Newsnight. And then I was on World Have Your Say with Anjem Chowdhury, which was quite fun. He was trying to explain what a brilliant sense of humour he has.
I mean, just for the context of this, though, essentially the thing that was being debated then in these Newsnight programmes and so on was, is it okay to offend religions in comedy?
Yes.
Is it, has the BBC gotten bias against Christianity and pro-Islam, something like that? The questions that were being raised?
I guess the question was, even the phrase that he mentioned, Muhammad coming to the mountain, which is a sort of a standard English phrase being used in a situation comedy, Elton felt under pressure just to take that out completely because it's just easier. And again, it goes kind of back to what we were saying a bit earlier about churches being funny about jokes. No one really wants to defend jokes because it's just a joke. And so it's just always easier to take out the joke, which is why a church or an institution will rather you didn't do the joke. Well, they like the idea of it, and then when they see what the joke is, they tend to shut it down, because otherwise they're going to have to go out and defend this joke, which they don't particularly want to do, because that's not their main business. And to be fair to the BBC, you know, they do defend jokes, and I don't want to do them down. And I wrote a show set in Afghanistan and about bomb disposal, and they defended that and I can't complain. But it's just a general state of affairs that institutions tend to worry and panic. And the bigger the institution, you would think, on one level, the easier it would be for them to basically shrug it all off. But actually, the bigger the institution, the more terrified they are. Yeah. And no one wants to be the weak link, the Buster Keaton who sets the little rock going that causes the landslide.
I think obviously with sensibilities so high around these issues, that can be where it gets triggered. I mean, Katie, do you find that comedians and the networks they may be producing material for are wary of religion being the butt of jokes generally? And does it make a difference which religion specifically?
Yeah, definitely. I found when I wrote my sketch show, I had a series of sketches called Jesus' Girlfriend, where the premise was Jesus had a girlfriend who Jesus was a bit of a kind of Russell Brand figure, right, who was a very charismatic guy with a sort of philosophical interests, but also, you know, very charming with a bit of an eye for the ladies, and also would kind of sometimes misspeak or cause a bit of a mess that then me as the long-suffering girlfriend was going to have to go around and just do all the PR, basically.
I see. Right.
And that, you know, he could never quite be bothered to write anything down, so I made sure everything was written down, and I brought Paul in to sort of do a bit more PR, and the apostles were just sort of trying to manage them and keep them on track, and I was kind of like trying to just organize everyone so that Jesus could just sort of do his freewheeling thing, even though he was a bit of a kind of,
right, you know, were basically the person trying to manage this rather esoteric freewheeling,
yeah,
thinker, and
yeah, exactly,
yeah. I
didn't worry, and I enjoyed it. It was one of my favourite sketches to write, and I brought all of my experience and my theology and everything, and I really had a lot of fun with those sketches. And ITV were sort of okay with them. I mean, everything you put on television has to go through a lawyer, and some channels' lawyers are more lax than others. So on ITV, they tend to be a little bit more sensitive because of their advertising profile than, say, Channel 4 might be, who will let you take greater risks. But I did six Jesus' Girlfriend sketches per series for three series, and they were okay. I don't remember them ever really objecting to anything in particular. One thing I was very careful to do is never to refer to him as Jesus Christ, because I've always understood that's tricky. If you just refer to him as Jesus is a historical figure, factually, you know, with a couple of sources, factually verified as having genuinely existed. And as a factual man in history, you can say what you like about Jesus, but as soon as you give him a kind of religious moniker, then you're into a slightly different thing. I don't particularly agree with that, but I understand that these can be fine distinctions. I mean, the other thing they objected to was a series of sketches I did about the royal family, just for context.
Right.
And I remember having a note from a lawyer saying people in this country have a lot of respect and love for the royal family and the church, and I just thought, okay, but, you know, the royal family and the church are fairly big, powerful institutions. I really think we should be allowed to make jokes about them.
Yeah.
I did write a sketch, and this has been in the press before, and this may well be taken up again and out of context, and so I just want to be clear that this has been talked about before.
Yeah.
But I did write some sketches about other religions, and I did write a sketch called The Imam of Dibley, which I thought would be funny, which was, again, a sort of just a very lighthearted, it wasn't brutal in any way, but it was just a fun spin on a kind of Muslim version of the Vicar of Dibley.
Uh-huh. Was that allowed through?
No. They said you can film it, but it'll be a waste of your money because it's not going to go on television.
Right. We're just going to go to a quick break, and I want to continue this conversation. Just so interesting. We're talking about what are the boundaries when it comes to religion and comedy? And we'll continue to talk about both your stories, James and Katie, who join me today, fellow comedians, talking about comedy, Christianity and taking offence here on the show that aims to get different people talking unbelievable. We'll be back in a moment's time.
After growing his Californian congregation from 30 members to 6,000, Francis Chan turned his back on the American megachurch model.
Look at churches. There are so many who exist that are not making disciples. People are not getting baptized, and yet they're spending a fortune. How is it then that the underground church in China grew to 100 million people?
Inspired by churches in Asia, the acclaimed preacher believes he's now promoting a more authentic expression of Christianity. Read the full interview with Francis Chan exclusively in this month's Premier Christianity magazine.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back. We're talking about comedy, Christianity and taking offence on the show today. James Carey and Katie Brand join me. They're both comedians. James, a BBC sitcom writer and theologian. His new book, The Sacred Art of Joking, opens up the pitfalls of comedy and religion in the modern world. Katie Brand has a really interesting story because she was a Christian in her teenage years, but she lost her faith and she talked about it in a stand-up show, I Was a Teenage Christian. I'm interested to hear more about that actually in a moment, Katie. She's also going to be involved in The Pilgrimage, new BBC series of that programme coming up at Easter. But we're talking today, and we've been talking about the boundaries of comedy and religion, and you were just telling the story, Katie, of the fact that it's not just Jesus and his girlfriend sort of comedy that you had taken on. You did try to get a comedy sketches recorded to do with the Imam of Dibley, something you say fairly you know, fairly mild in a sense, but they weren't going to let that through. You wanted to sort of finish your thought on that.
Yeah, it was just that what a number of us have probably had, comedians who have written about faith or Christianity or any religion, but particularly Christianity, have had levelled at us on many occasions, is you'll make jokes about Christianity, but you won't make jokes about Islam. Mm. And that's because you're too scared, because Christians are nice, reasonable people, and you're frightened of the consequences of making jokes about Islam, given things that have happened over the last decade or so to people who have tried. Mm. And I think, you know, I'm not going to argue that there's not an element of truth in that for some people, but I think also there's a lot of unseen stuff that people are writing and are not, and people, and it's actually the people in charge of the platform that are worried about putting it out. And I've had that happen a number of times. Sure. But also, just one more thought on this, is that the thing I would always say to someone who says to me, why don't you ever write about this? You're happy to talk about Christianity, but you won't talk about X, Y, Z, is that it's because I know Christianity. I was brought up in Christianity. I was a Christian myself. I have a theology degree. I write jokes about things, broadly speaking, that I know about or have some sense of understanding of what the jokes are about. And James talks about this in his book, about having to have a common understanding of things in order to, you have to both know what you're talking about in order to satirize it or turn it upside down or do something unexpected in order to find it funny. And I simply don't know enough about the religious practices and inner workings of other religions, including Islam, to be able to make good jokes about it. I certainly don't want to make bad jokes.
Mm. And even if you did, your audience don't.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but the problem is it's a problem of commissioning. It's a problem of diversity. Don't ask, the people who are in charge of commissioning need to give a lot more opportunity to comedians and comic writers of other faiths to explore the jokes that are relevant and funny within that, because they will know what those jokes are. So that's what I would like to see, is more comedians from other faiths having the opportunity to make the jokes they want to make about those faiths. What it shows to me is that there's too many people like me on television, and we don't know how to make those jokes, and we shouldn't really be trying.
James.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to say was when you were talking about how people were offending, you said you talked about the lawyer who was saying, well, actually people like church and the Christian faith and people like the royal family. And the thing I'm trying to challenge a bit, partly with the book, is I think Christians particularly have an unrealistic and unbiblical view of offence and what it is. And in particular, they don't actually have a Christian view of what it is. Because if you read Jesus, if you read about him in the Gospels, you will find a man who goes out of his way to offend people. Mm. He actually calls Pharisees and Sadducees names that he knows they will hate. He calls them vipers. He calls them whitewashed tombs. He calls them murderers. And even with his friends, the disciples, he constantly makes their life difficult and upsets them and challenges them. He was really awkward. And so he really knew how to ruin the mood, but challenge it in a good way as well as in a difficult way. So I'm really unhappy with the idea that Christians think that they should be able to sail through life not being offended by anything, because the Jesus is offensive, the Bible is incredibly offensive, and sometimes you get bits in church when you know what's going to happen next and they're going to be read out loud and you think, oh, hang on, this will be interesting, because we're about to get some very grown-up material here. And it feels like we're actually presenting a false view of what the Christian faith actually is. So one of my kind of pleas really is for us to go back to what the Bible actually says and read it well. And one of the things that when you do that, not only do you find how offensive it is, but also you find how funny it is. Mm. I just had one of these weird examples the other day. In fact, on Sunday, I was in church. We were reading about the Israelites in the desert. And then I remembered what somebody said, and I looked it up during the sermon about the quails. So it's interesting how the Israelites are in the desert.
Yeah.
They're hungry. They get bread that rains down. Mm-hmm. You know, it's there in the morning. Mm-hmm. And they're thirsty. They get water. Then they sail. Then they say, "We want meat." And God is quite angry with them at this point. But he says, "Oh, fine, I'll give you meat." When you actually look at how much meat is provided, it's about a meter's high worth of quails, as far as the eye can see in every direction. I mean, that's quite funny.
Right.
And I believe it's sort of meant to be funny. It's like, you wanted quails.
Yeah.
I'll give you quails.
And I think that's true if you read a lot of Old Testament stories like Jonah. There's a lot of humour that perhaps we don't realise now, with a modern sort of lenses on, that the first readers would have found utterly, like, it's deliberately making things ridiculously over the top.
And I don't think it's just us reading it in as well, because I think God himself doing jokes, I mean, Jesus is funny in ways that we could talk about, but actually, you know, God, Yahweh, in the Old Testament, in one of my favourite bits is in 1 Samuel 5, the Philistines have captured the Ark of the Covenant, and this amazing ark, which is representing God on earth and contains the Ten Commandments and all that kind of stuff. And the Philistines, they drag it into their temple, the temple of Dagon, who is a really vile god. And they put it next to Dagon and say, "There we go. We've got two gods. Hey, look at us." And then they all go off to bed. And then the next morning they come back in, and Dagon is face down. This massive stone statue is face down in front of the Ark of the Covenant. Mm. And they go, "Oh, that's weird. I wonder how that happened." So they put the statue back up again. And then they go, and then the next day they come back in, and the statue is not only face down, but is now in bits in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And you read that and you just think, "Oh, that's funny. That's really funny." I mean, if you believe
it's a bit Marx Brothers, isn't it?
Well, it is. And you just think that is, I mean, God knows he's being funny by doing that. That is really subversive. And so it's not just finding words and bits and moments in the Bible funny, which they are. But I do believe that God is showing us how funny he is and how much he embraces the absurdity and the incongruities that we live in today in life.
Did you get any Christians objecting to your stand-up show about your early life as a Christian, Katie, when you put that on?
The main objections came from people who never saw the show or had any intention of seeing the show.
Right, okay.
So I would say,
that's a very, any, as you know, that's a long Christian tradition, is criticising something you haven't seen. You should have known that was going to...
Yes, anything very, very angry and very sort of judgmental and furious, I always knew that's come from someone who hasn't seen it and will never see it. And I would always invite them to see it. I'd say, "Come and see it first and then tell me what you think afterwards, because you may change your mind. Because I'm not sure it's quite what you think it is." It's a very personal story about me and what happened to me. It's not a story one thing I never do is sneer at people who have a sincere faith. I may think, "Oh, this person seems very hypocritical whilst they're saying that they're this Christian and then behaving like this." But that isn't the same as sneering at a sincere person who has faith, which I will never do. Certainly not about just the fact of having faith. I never laugh at someone simply because they have sincere faith. But there are other aspects which are open season for me. And I sometimes had Christians come along and wait for me afterwards and want to talk to me. But really, they did want to talk to me, but what they really wanted to do is pray for me. And I had that on several occasions of people coming up and trying to start a process that I'm very, very familiar with from my teenage years, that I had sort of every week, if not more, for 7 years, and was on the prayer team and was a trained member of the prayer team. So I know what they're going to do in terms of laying on of hands. I know what the protocol is. I know the kinds of things they're going to say and the reaction that they're looking for to some extent. And I would normally just have a nice brief chat and then say, I mean, I did honestly have to go home, but a few times they would sort of say, "Oh, you know, if only you came to our church," or "if only if you knew," because I don't name anyone or I'm not explicit in the show about the names of anything. I would never do that. And sometimes it was almost comical because people they were naming that I ought to come and meet because they were sort of exemplary Christians, I knew them already, and I probably had a different view of that person. Mm. So there were kind of times where we were talking at cross purposes, but I never wanted to expose or humiliate them. I just have a polite chat, then sort of politely decline the offer of prayer in the theatre, and then just say, it's really nice to meet you, and I don't know what
they're going to pray for you anyway, though. You know that.
Of course. I don't mind people praying for me in their own. They do whatever they like in their own personal time.
Just,
I just don't want a name on me.
Yeah.
Not while they're de-rigging the theatre.
No, that's as well.
Not in the car park.
Yeah, the fringe, especially the fringe as well. You basically got about 8 minutes to get out.
I know. Like,
now is not the time.
This isn't, there's no time to be slain in the spirit.
Yeah, this is right. Yeah.
I mean, what about the reaction of the, you know, everyone else, the non-Christians in a sense, who could go along to a show like that, I suppose the worry might be the Christians might be thinking she's going to make out that having faith is just a kind of load of baloney and ridiculous. I mean, that's not what your intention is, as I hear it.
No, absolutely not. And I'm actually fascinated by people of faith, and I think it can be very beautiful. And in fact, until very recently, I was an agnostic. So it's only literally in the last 6 months that I have become a fully formed atheist. So
right.
I've always been very fascinated about all of that stuff. And also I say in the show, I'm very careful to say in the show, that when I went to university and I did my degree, a lot of my tutors and professors and lecturers were people of faith. Some of them were active clergy.
Mm.
And I had a monk who was one of my tutors for patristics, and that was not, you know, I it wasn't that all, I realized it's not all Christians that are worried about me doing this degree or talking about these things in a very sort of scrutinizing way. It's just the particular type of church, and maybe even just the specific church I went to and the people I was with that kind of, I found that we just didn't have any common ground anymore. So I also say that in the show. It's not, you know, hashtag not all Christians.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of, you know, even the evangelical element of the Church of England and the very extreme level of the evangelical fundamentalist element of the Church of England, and even just individuals within that, not even everyone in that church. It's just it was that kind of pressure and slightly oppressive atmosphere I found in the end that was what I wanted to get away from.
It's frustrating to listen to because if you go back to what Jesus is actually like, I think it's so frustrating when people have a negative experience because again, going back to the church being authoritarian, it's so annoying when Jesus just wasn't like that. And he never chases after people who, you know, he quite often says stuff to people and they say, well, that's a load of rubbish, and they walk away.
I think you can feel that about Jesus, whatever faith you are, whether I'm still a great admirer of Jesus, and like you say, I think he said some incredibly interesting, profound, truthful things, provocative things. I'm a big fan of Jesus. I think the point people want to walk away is when you're told the only way you're going to get to heaven is through faith in Jesus rising again. Mm. And that's what makes you a Christian. So you can be an admirer of Jesus, which I am, without being a Christian. So I don't feel I've walked away from Jesus. Mm. I just feel I've walked away from the sort of specific principle of Christianity, which is a faith in him rising again and that being the only route to heaven.
Yeah. I think my point was mainly that it's frustrating when, again, Christians think they're doing the right thing by modelling what they think is Christian behaviour, which is sometimes sort of yelling at people and trying to control them. And that's just not what Jesus did. He was much more comfortable with disagreement. It's comfortable to the point where they killed him. I mean, that's a tough crowd. You know, and there are bits in the Gospels where Jesus is speaking and it says basically people started looking around for rocks to throw at him, and you can and then he sort of slipped away, and it's just like, wow, that's worse than jungles.
That's worse than, you know.
Yeah. Late in life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what would be your advice, I don't know, to a Christian who does, and it may not be what Katie did it with her stage show, but you talk about some of the other things that Christians have reacted to, like the Jerry Springer opera now, again, going back a few years now, but where there's more of an obvious kind of, poking fun at / ridiculing of you know, well-known religious character and so on. And there were protests and people saying this isn't good enough.
And it's coming back, apparently, this year. It might come back.
The Jerry Springer, the opera returns.
Okay. It does, indeed. I mean, one example I give in the book is the Book of Mormon stage show, the musical.
Oh, yeah.
And I have to say, Mormons tend to be incredibly nice, and so they were incredibly nice about it.
Yeah.
They must really hate it, because the show really does make Mormonism look completely ridiculous, which is what the show set out to do. I think some think that show is a metaphor for all Christian faith or all organized religion. And I think, no, it's quite specific about Mormonism.
What I like, though, about, because that was created by the creators of South Park, right?
That's right. Yeah.
What I like, though, is that they, to give them their due, have also sent up Richard Dawkins in South Park and
absolutely.
That kind of thing. So it's not like it's just one element of the worldview sort of tradition
they really don't care who they offend.
Game,
everyone's fair game. And that's why, I mean, I think Team America World Police is a tough watch if you're a Christian, because the language is pretty fruity. But I love the way it wishes a plague on both your houses. It sort of says, here's one group of people and they're complete idiots. And here are the people who hate those people and they're idiots too. It's not terribly constructive, but it is good to know how idiotic we all are and how much we all fall short, as it were. So I think there are ways of... Because you don't have to say you like something. You don't have to approve of it. My worry is when what Christians sometimes do, particularly, and I can only really speak for Christians, is we, with Jerry Springer, the opera, for example, we demanded that it basically be taken down, it be stopped in some way, and there was a private prosecution for blasphemy, laws which no longer are in force. And actually, we're not required to do that, and I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the Bible teaches about what the state is for and the government, the magistrate is for, and what the church is for. And so what you're trying to do is fuse church and state together to say that the state should intervene and stop the church from being humiliated. And you go, no, that's not, I don't think that's what Jesus was talking about when he's talking about rendering unto Caesar and all those sorts of passages. And so I worry that Christians are offended. They are jealous for the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. And I totally understand that. And I feel that too. So when I watched Jerry Springer the opera, I was amused in some places, I was impressed in other places, I was incredibly offended in other places, but I had to watch it in order to have an opinion about it.
Yeah.
But what I don't think is a fundamentally biblical view is to say, can the government please now shut this down?
Right.
Which is not...
But it's okay for Christians to say, I don't like this.
Completely
and,
fine.
And I think this was a terrible production.
Yes.
Or whatever. That's their right, I suppose.
That's their right,
to kind of say, yeah. I suppose it's not, what it isn't is a case of saying we need to take the law now to kind of stop other people saying what they want
about
our faith.
Because if your benchmark of is your own personal level of offence, or indeed anyone being offended, that's going to catch you because people don't like Christianity. And there'll come a point where people say, I don't want to have Christianity thrown at me. I'm offended by it.
Yeah.
So let's have that one squashed from public life as well. So we will be the net losers in that if we're Christians.
What do you think, Katie? Is there a kind of, I don't know, a line which shouldn't be crossed in comedy as far as you're concerned when it comes to the potential to give offence to people, especially obviously when it comes to religion?
I think that's two separate questions. I mean, my baseline is always no. I don't think there should be any line in terms of what anyone can say, except for two things, which I think is the basis of the law. I know there have been other laws added in terms of freedom of speech, and I'm not sure what I think about some of those. But the two baselines for me are, one, you cannot defame someone living. You can't destroy their reputation knowingly by telling lies about them.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing you can't do is put someone in fear of their physical safety. You can't make a legitimate physical threat directly at an individual and make them worry that they're going to be physically harmed or killed. Those are, for me, the two basic things. That doesn't necessarily mean that I don't have my own personal lines,
sure,
but they're personal to me. Beyond those two things, you can't defame someone and you can't put them in fear of their physical safety. Other than that, you pretty much say anything. Whether you choose to say it and what kind of sort of decency you apply in terms of what you should or shouldn't say is up to the individual. And there are some people who are very offended by certain stand-ups and would never want to go and watch them, but no one's suggesting what they're saying is illegal. It might be distasteful. My personal view is, I really hesitate about doing anything that I would perceive about an attribute or characteristic of someone that they haven't chosen.
Okay,
so
that's an interesting way of putting it.
someone doesn't choose their ethnicity or their race. Someone doesn't choose, you know, whether they're able-bodied or have challenges in that way. Mm. Someone doesn't choose, I believe, whether they're gay or straight. You know, so I think those are the things you don't. And to some extent as well, people's personal appearance. I tend right. to hesitate away
yeah.
from that.
Yeah.
Those would be my own. But that doesn't mean I'm going to judge anyone who talks about those things. That's their decision. But in terms of religious offence, I don't have a line. I just don't have a line. I think people choose. What I don't do is satire. As I say, if people have a sincere faith, I don't go at them and act like they're stupid or sneer at them for their own sincere faith.
Sure.
Anything else, though, anything about the Bible, anything about religious figures, anything at all, I think is absolutely up for anything for anyone to say. Mm. And people can be offended. And that's fine. That's just the way we all move on.
And
I'll say this, you're offended, and we go on.
And in a way, interestingly, it's been interesting on a few occasions to see actually comedians and secularists and Christians joining forces when they felt there's a common interest, because I've seen when there's been a threat to maybe Christians who want to preach openly on the street. Mm. And mm-hmm. and that is all equally affected by bills and regulations around freedom of speech as it mm. does to comedians and so on. So I think it was Rowan Atkinson and others who got yeah. together with the Christian Institute, which is part
well,
of
as someone who literally off my own bat used to go and preach in my local shopping centre yeah. on Saturday morning as a 15-year-old, I'm very glad that people were not able to beat me up.
Was that a good training ground?
Anyone,
for...
a passing comedian would step in if necessary.
Was that a good training ground for stand-up comedy? Reflecting back on it now, Katie?
Yeah, probably. I certainly, you know, you'll never be heckled quite like that again. Anything that happens in a comedy club is fairly mild. But, you know, people want to talk to you and challenge you and come up and discuss it. And I was just always up for the discussion. I enjoyed the discussion.
Hmm. Do you look back on yourself and think it was almost like a different person back then, the teenage Katie Brand?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm horrifically quite similar. I just think I've changed my focus. You know, I was quite stubborn. I was quite bloody minded in many ways. Once I decided to do something, I would do it regardless. And I, you know, if I wanted to do something, I would do it absolutely full pelt. You know, so all of those, I liked being at the center of the action. I liked having a purpose. I liked feeling important. I liked being busy. I liked it when we went off for a weekend and painted a homeless shelter and all of that sort of stuff. So it definitely, I have a lot about me that's the same as when I was a teenager. The things I don't recognize about myself and that I that are nothing to do with what I think or say now are the more sort of socially conservative aspects of the type of evangelical church that I was at. So the attitudes to gay people, the attitude towards sex before marriage, the attitudes towards male and female roles within the church and at home, and also, you know, the idea that you can only get to heaven through belief in Christ. So those are the things I no longer recognize, I don't agree with, or I don't believe in. But in terms of my actual personality, I think I'm quite similar. I think some of the things that made me get into Christianity and into the church so much are the same things that have propelled me through my career now.
Right.
You know, so I definitely think there's I don't disown my teenage self at all.
Yeah, I mean, just before we go to our final break, James, I'm interested in your view as someone who, you know, is a pretty, you know, committed Christian.
Mm.
I say pretty. I'm sure you are a committed Christian.
And very pretty.
And thank
very,
you. And pretty.
Yeah.
But in a sense, hearing Katie say it's those elements that she's now obviously uncomfortable with, that wouldn't agree with. Can a Christian be a comedian and believe in something as serious as there's only one way to God and it's Jesus Christ? It's kind of like that's a serious thing.
Yeah.
To kind of have a, you know, so in a sense, it's understandable why it would feel like, okay,
I think that may not be, I think it's partly affected by the people that you hang out with as well. So when you're part of a church group, you're going to adopt the theology of that group. And then actually one of the things I wonder if was quite intoxicating when you went to Oxford is that you find a new group of people who are comedy based. And actually that's often a very close-knit group that kind of does all of the things and fulfills all of the emotional and social needs and desire to be part of community that actually church does for lots of people as well.
No, I think that's very true.
Yeah. So I think therefore it is obviously hard to be socially very conservative in the media when the media tends to be people who are very, very progressive in lots of areas. But in a way, the beauty of comedy, I think, is because comedy is ultimately about truth, or at least giving the truth as you see it. As long as you're sticking to what you think is true, then, you know, you will do jokes around that and reveal truth. And actually, even if people think that you are that you are not truthful, that you are wrong, their reaction to your joke will itself be truthful. And so if people are offended by a joke, or worse, and again, this is why churches maybe don't like comedy, is because if something bad happens to someone and then you laugh out loud, we've heard you laugh at that. We've heard you snigger, which is why the worst place to get the giggles is a funeral, is because if you're caught laughing at a funeral, people will think you are a terrible person. And that makes it funnier. And so you can't take your laugh back. And so I think because at the heart of comedy is truth, because a joke that isn't true isn't really funny. And sometimes people don't find jokes funny because to them they're not true. That's not a fair stereotype, or that's not a true fact, or whatever it is. So I think in a way I think you can have any position. You can have any theology you like, or be secular, or be a Zoroastrian. You have an experience of a faith group, of a community, of a group of people, of a family that you can share with people. And because a lot of comedy is based on incongruity, you can sort of show how that butts up against all of the other things of the world that we live in, or those sorts of things, or the preconceptions of the audience. So I think extreme points of view are fine, whether they're socially conservative or incredibly progressive. Comedically, obviously, I have a much stronger preference myself. But again, audiences don't tend to differentiate, and Christians in particular say, I didn't like that joke, I don't like that comedian. And you go, well, no, you don't like it. But that's not to say that it's not funny. So when they said The Life of Brian, they were criticising it, and they said what a 10th-rate film it was. You go, no, it's a really good film, you just hate it. And that's fine.
We're going to go to another quick break. Sorry, Katie, I'll just go to a quick break and I'll come back to you. We're just going to go to our final break, and we'll be finishing up this great conversation today between Katie Brand and James Carey, talking comedy, Christianity and taking offence. You're listening to Unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading sceptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, bringing you, as ever, conversations that matter between Christians and non-Christians. And looking forward to the final part of the discussion between Katie Brand and James Carey. Don't forget that you can find loads more conversations if you simply download the podcast. Go to our website for all the links, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. People get in touch with me every week who've just started listening to the show, just found it, and very often start to binge on the back catalogue. Many of those topics and issues very evergreen, so you can go way back and gorge yourself for as long as you like. Coming up next week, really interesting discussion. I'm going to be joined by former Planned Parenthood employee Sue Taya, who's going to be talking about her experience of being part of that abortion provider service in the USA, why she left it, why she now campaigns against it in the pro-life movement 40 Days for Life. She'll be debating Anne Furedi of the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, the leading abortion provider here in the UK. We're going to be asking, has abortion law gone too far? Looking at some of the recent controversies in the USA, for instance, where New York have passed legislation allowing termination up to birth, and also the moves that BPAS and Anne Furedi want to make here in the UK to decriminalise abortion completely and to allow abortion up to term for any reason. So that'll be our subject next week. It's going to be a big one. If you can come back, we'll be aiming to film that as well and release it on the YouTube channel. If you're here on Premier Christian Radio and you can stick around, John Dixon is my guest on The Profile next. He's here between 4 and 5, and you might have heard him previously on Unbelievable talking about their new documentary, For the Love of God. He's an Australian Bible scholar, got such an interesting past. He was in a rock band, and he's the founder of the Centre for Public Christianity out in Australia. So look out for his complete life story and his thoughts on all kinds of things, including the fact that he had a hand in the creation of one of Hillsong's most popular songs, The Creed. You'll find out all about that between 4 and 5 this afternoon, or on its own Profile podcast. Just look for The Profile wherever you get your podcast from. I should say that for those who listen to the Unbelievable podcast, we have been hearing of some issues with those who try to access it via Google Podcasts or Stitcher. Seems that the feed hasn't been updating for a little while there. We're trying to work out why that is. We're not entirely sure, but we'll try and get to the bottom of it. I guess if you do listen those ways, you won't even be hearing this. But if you know someone who's had trouble, there are many other podcasting platforms that are working absolutely fine for Unbelievable, and you can get the downloads just as easily as you like. Do join our newsletter though if you want to make sure you're completely up to date with all the latest articles and videos and resources, etc. I posted just recently a tribute to Michael Green, who of course passed away this last week, a phenomenal evangelist and apologist for many decades, and you can find that on the social media of Unbelievable as well, at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB as well. Another thing I posted in the Unbelievable newsletter this last week, and if you subscribe to the newsletter, you'll get all of these goodies coming every fortnight, is an exclusive video of N.T. Wright playing Bob Dylan, no less. Yes, this was an outtake from the Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast series, which we began at the end of last year. You can see him playing When the Ship Comes In exclusively for the Ask N.T. Wright sessions if you go and subscribe to the newsletter. That's all available from the website of the show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding our conversation on comedy, Christianity, taking offence, James Carey and Katie Brand have been with me on the show today. Do get hold of James's book, The Sacred Art of Joking, or Why Jokes So Often Go Horribly Wrong. It's published by SBCK. And you can find out more about him at jamescarey.co.uk. If you want more about Katie Brand and all the various things she's into and is working on at the moment, katiebrandofficial.com. And you have got this the pilgrimage programme coming up. I know it's all hush-hush and you can't tell us too much about it at this point, Katie, but briefly it involves you and a few others going on a pilgrimage essentially, and they film it.
Yes, that's right. The BBC Two did the first series a couple of years ago, and it was a huge success. Had people like Ed Byrne in it and Kate Botley, and it was a massive success. So they commissioned a second series of which I am a part. So we filmed walking the old, called Via Francigena, which is the old northern European pilgrimage route from Canterbury to Rome. And we just did the section that went from Switzerland and down through Italy to Rome. So we walked that on our pilgrimage. We stayed in hostels, humble hostels, and we met other pilgrims along the way. And we kind of talked about God and faith and our feelings, and drank in all the history, drank in all the wine. And made it to the Vatican.
Wow.
Well, I believe it was announced last week that we met the Pope, which we did.
Well, there
you go.
Which
was an extraordinary and fascinating experience. yes, it'll be interesting to see how it's edited. But it was me and Les Dennis, Brendan Cole, Leslie Joseph, Dana Scallon, Stephen K. Amos, Maureen Baig, and Greg Rutherford. So there were eight of us, all from very different backgrounds, all with very different types of faith or no faith. And we had some fantastic conversations, absolutely fantastic conversations. And so, it was hard. And we did a lot of quite hard walking and carrying everything we needed on our backs and all of that sort of stuff that goes along with a pilgrimage. But that's all part of it, really. So it was an unbelievable experience. I mean, completely life-changing experience. And it's probably the first time since I did my degree that I've really had time and set aside time, which was partly why I wanted to do it, to really think about what I feel now and who I am now in terms of, in the context of any kind of faith at all. So that was a really interesting time.
Has it had the opposite effect? Because you were saying earlier that you've subsequently become an atheist. So I'm thinking this pilgrimage has probably had slightly unexpected results for you.
Yes, it did have unexpected results. Actually, I went in an agnostic and came out an atheist.
Wow.
So
okay.
If people want to see a bit of that journey, I share that journey, that mental journey that I have on the show. That was totally unexpected. If anything, I thought that I was going to go the other way, to be honest. Not become a fully fledged Christian again, but I thought I would. And I offered up some prayers along the way and all of this sort of stuff. And it wasn't a sad thing at all. It wasn't in any way something that's made me feel sad or bereft. I feel very joyful and excited and totally kind of, you know, the beauty of nature and the universe. And I felt this is enough. It's enough. That's what I felt, and I actually feel the pressure to always be looking for hidden meanings and all of that kind of stuff has actually gone away from me now. I feel much more relaxed. So I always reserve the right to change my mind, but for now, that's where I am
now,
and I
feel
really good about
it. That's interesting.
Yeah, and I feel good. And again, you know, I think a lot of people feel that very, very militant atheists share a lot in common with very, very militant people of a religious faith, and I agree with that. I think we can all just, you know, give a little and listen a little and talk and be interested in one another. That doesn't mean we can't then write some good comedy about it, but the starting point has to be just being interested in other people and not wanting to shut them down and then try and pull them apart somehow.
Yeah. What's your response to the journey? Well, where obviously Katie finds herself now in terms of faith and indeed comedy.
Well, again, it's just a question of being honest, isn't it? And you can only really tell the truth as you see it. Obviously, I've reached extremely different conclusions, and if we went on a pilgrimage together, I'm not sure that would be great telly, but you never know. I'm fascinated to see because people don't have the experiences that you think, and I'm sure lots of other people were surprised by their reactions to how they felt when they actually go through that. So to me, probably going to Rome would not probably create the effect that, you know, going to somewhere like Wittenberg, where Martin Luther and the 95 Theses was a big thing, and that's for me more of a significant place. But, you know, Rome's pretty good.
The Pope's box office, though.
He is box office. He is, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he is one of the big names.
It's Bono and then the Pope, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, you know, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I think it's probably as far as Bono's concerned, to be honest.
Yeah, no, that is true. That is true, yes. Bono would be appalled by being put on a parallel with him.
He wouldn't be second billing to anyone.
Absolutely, yeah.
Where do we find ourselves in the end? You're not here to defend or try to persuade Katie out of her current, you know, where she finds herself as an atheist nowadays, James. But do you ever see it in your role as a comedian to in any way defend Christianity or to kind of in some way reflect the worldview you do hold, which is someone who does see themselves as a follower of Christ?
Well, yeah, one of the things I try to do, on the rare occasions I get to depict any kind of Christianity on television or radio, is to try and at least get it accurate. And so there are loads of things, and occasionally I talk about this when I do a live show version of The Sacred Art of Joking. I talk about how there are lots of things that happen that only Christians on TV do that Christians don't do in real life. For example, sing Kumbaya. You know, we don't sing Kumbaya and haven't done for 30 or 40 years. And if we do, we're joking.
Okay. It's being done ironically. Okay.
Yeah. And so I think because my worry is often that lots of people who write who write comedy and write drama, actually they don't actually know that many Christians, and therefore they take their cues about what Christianity is actually like from other things they've seen on TV, and lots of those things are fairly old stereotypes,
which is why I think, as Katie said, Rev was a bit of a groundbreaking
go
ahead, Katie.
I think, you know, there was because I agree, I think some of these old stereotypes about Christians sort of being a bit woolly and wearing sandals and singing Kumbaya and not being really sure about anything and just having a cup of tea, they are very old-fashioned. And, you know, the kind of characters that I would write and have written as Christians now are totally different to that. And the joke for me would be completely different. Mm. And, you know, there were a number of Christians I encountered who were constantly talking about being humble whilst desperately wanting as much attention as they could possibly get. Like, and a lot of the stuff that I was involved in was very slick. I mean, very high level production values and all of that sort of stuff. And one of the best jokes that I saw, again, I must have been in a very small clutch of people who really appreciated the brilliance of the writing on this, was a character in Rev, which was a local, very cool, very smart evangelical vicar played by Darren Boyd,
who
came in and was obviously much, much better at bringing the youth in and all of that. And he started talking about having a smoothie machine and that just, and how he was going to Greenbelt. And that just cracked me up immediately, because one of the things we used to do in my youth group is run a Friday night band night where we'd have live music and a fully advertised smoothie maker.
Wow. Yeah.
And I just thought, that is a niche. That is a niche joke. But very, a very fresh and modern take on it. And I just thought, you know, if you did get more Christians writing stuff, sharp, brilliant Christians writing comedy, you'd get much fresher.
Yeah, I agree.
People who felt confident within their faith and in their religious communities that they won't be ostracized if they kind of slightly, you know, send this sort of stuff up a little bit, then you will get away from these kind of slightly boring and out of date stereotypes.
Well, what I liked though was that, that at the center of that program, there was Tom Hollander playing Rev, and it was very funny, but it was like this very human and honest depiction of someone who it struggles with their faith, but is also faithful and does what they feel they're called to do. And I kind of, I appreciated that a great deal.
And I would like to say as well, I really would like to say that after all that I've said, there were people at my church who I remember very clearly who were like that, who were a great support, very human, good sense of humor, really genuinely fun people to be with, who I would happily hang out now. I don't know if they'd happily hang out with me, but I would happily hang out with them now. You know, there were others who I thought were appalling hypocrites, and then everybody in between, you know. So the church is a broad community of real humans.
And as are all faith groups.
Yeah, indeed.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I always feel like, you know, Christianity is not going to make you a different person. It's just going to magnify who you already are. If you're already a great person, then I think you could be greater through your faith. And I saw that.
That's
if you're already a person... Yeah. who wants to be at the forefront of everything and control people and try and, you know, carve people off into little gangs and play them off against each other, then perhaps the church leadership role will also allow you to do that.
Yeah.
And I saw both.
Yeah. James, any final thoughts as we close out the show?
Yeah, obviously I think that being a Christian means that by the power of the Holy Spirit, you become more like Jesus. But that doesn't often seem to be evident. But I think in one sense, church does, I think when churches... is done badly, you do get all these things. And when it's done well, you get lots of these things, which is why I think the Babylon Bee has really found a really good tone, so which, you know, which is often shared on Facebook.
For those who don't know, it's kind of the Onion for Christians in a way.
Spoof news headlines about which really do hit the mark. And they are, again, within the church, they are an equal opportunities offender. So they'll have a proper go at progressive liberals
to major more on the American side of things. So you'd have to be somewhat familiar with some of the issues going on.
But it's called the Babylon Bee.
Babylon Bee.
You'll get lots of jokes. So it gives charismatics a good kicking. It gives progressives and liberals a good kicking. It gives Calvinists like me a really good kicking as well.
If you're a Calvinist, you saw the kicking coming. Wow.
Well, there you go.
The old ones are always the best.
That's right. The faith that Jesus you. But again, I think that's why the church needs to embrace comedy, because these frailties and these absurdities, incongruities, these hypocrisies, which again Jesus was really hot on. He would say, you know, you terrible people who do this, you say this and yet you do that, and they didn't like it. And I think it always worries me that Christians can be in the end rather try to be holier than Jesus and holier than the Bible, and we know from reading the Bible that doesn't go well.
We've had such a good time. It's been such fun discussing this today. Thank you so much, Katie and James, for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Katie, we look forward to watching you.
I've learned a lot, actually.
Oh, that's great.
It's a really interesting conversation.
And I'm so sorry.
We look forward to seeing you on the pilgrimage at some point over Easter the BBC, Katie. James, all the best with the book. Thank you very much both for being on the show today.
Thank you very much for
having us.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Look forward to hearing what you made of today's programme. Do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. You can leave thoughts via Twitter as well, @unbelievablejb, to do it that way. Something I should have mentioned, actually, James Carey has a great podcast called Cooper and Carey Have Words. Very funny, talking about all issues, church, theology, comedy and such like. So do go and check that out if you can. And that will actually be the featured podcast on the brand new Premier podcast show, which airs on Sunday nights with Lady T. So that's tomorrow night if you're listening here on Premier Christian Radio. Here's some of your feedback. And we had a lot to the show with Raymond Tallis and David Bentley Hart talking about consciousness and logos and going very deep and philosophical with it. But last week's show, of course, was quite phenomenal, really, when Peter Atkins and John Lennox sat down in front of students at Southampton University for a debate I moderated there. It was live streamed on our YouTube channel. Had a lot of views that way, a lot of commentary that way as well. But here are some of the comments that came in via email. This one says, from Peter, says, I tried valiantly, I really did, to listen to the whole show of the dialogue between Atkins and Lennox, but I just couldn't do it. Please, please, I beg you, no more shows with Peter Atkins. He literally has nothing new to say. I didn't bother to listen to the show the last time you had him on because he never makes any new arguments, any new thoughts, but worst of all, never seems to listen to or care about what his dialogue partner is saying. This week I thought I'd give it a go, but alas, he pulled out the same canards he always deploys. A checklist of stock phrases that he seems to prefer. Lazy thinking, stupid questions, silly questions, no evidence, and it never happened. All assertions made without the slightest meaningful attempt to provide explanation. Listening to him has become nauseatingly tedious. Please put him on the list of former guests of the show. Okay, I hear you, Peter. Rob Knetch says, just listen to that debate. As a frequent listener to the podcast, almost from the start of its release, I dread every time Atkins is on, and the debate just proved why. With all due respect, for the life of me, I can't understand why you still have him on. Please, I beg you, don't have him on again. Okay. And Richard Scott Watson says, as ever, a fascinating and engaging debate. Good. Also, as ever, Peter Atkins fell at the atheist hurdle that they all fall at. He's an eminent scientist, but his claim that no evidence could persuade him that God exists is as unscientific an approach as possible, and he knows it. They all fall at the same point. Contrast John Lennox's approach, that, like most of us, if you provide the evidence that faith in Jesus is false, we would have to consider it and act accordingly. The problem for the atheist is that Christians can provide plenty of evidence for God and Jesus, but atheists can provide no evidence against allowed evidence for non-existence is very difficult to find. I was surprised that John Lennox didn't put the point that as more and more is discovered in astrophysics, the likelihood of us being here by chance alone goes from infinitesimal to incredulous. But he knows so much about so many subjects, maybe there just isn't room for that one. Thank you very much, Richard, for getting in touch. Yes, and those sorts of remarks were repeated a number of times. However, there were also lots of people who really enjoyed, as it were, the drama, let's say, of the interactions that took place. Yes, well, we'll see whether Peter Atkins makes it onto the show again in future. I'm sure John Lennox will. Okay, we also had a lot of reactions to David Bentley Hart and Raymond Tallis debating consciousness, logos, making sense of the world. Raymond Tallis, the atheist philosopher, David Bentley Hart, the orthodox theologian and philosopher. And I mean, what you will find if you go back and listen to it is it was a deep dive. It got pretty intellectual, fairly high level. I was struggling to keep up a lot of the time, if I'm honest. And I did say this will be a tough one for many people on my Twitter account. And a lot of people got back to say, actually, I really enjoyed it. And I sort of tweeted, well, I've obviously underestimated just how smart the unbelievable audience is. So people like David Robertson got in touch to say, I loved it, thought both were exceptional, but it did hurt my head. Tony said, I'm not sure if my brain, mind or consciousness is bruised, but my head hurts. What an insightful yet challenging episode. And Chris said, great episode, my first time to hear about and from David Bentley Hart, would love to see him back on again. And Rick said, similar, great episode, now we just need another episode to make sense of them making sense of the world. But on the other hand, people like Steve said, I'm afraid I'm not part of that smart demographic, as I gave up halfway through it. It's me, not them, though. Philosophy isn't really my thing. Still, at least the guinea pigs got their runs cleaned out whilst I was giving it a go. And Andreas said, well, I for one did not understand half of what David
Bentley Hart tried to convey. I thought I had a good grasp for a non-English speaker on the English language. It seems like I was wrong. I wouldn't do yourself down, Andreas. I think even a very committed English speaker may have struggled to follow some of the points that were being made. And Johannes says, is there someone willing to translate their main points of difference into plain language? I love David Bentley Hart, but sometimes he retreated so far into his own private language and very particular definition of a term that it became quite impenetrable. Thank you very much for those responses on Twitter. Here's some that came in via email. Ian said, wow, Justin, that Logos debate with especially David Bentley Hart was hard to listen to. A masterclass in non-communication. I even had the feeling your usual deft touch in handling your speakers was struggling. David Bentley Hart was unable to answer even basic questions without making it sound like a tortuous maze of what I assume were connected thoughts in his own mind, but in reality completely lost his audience. And that's what's remarkable, is you were able to sustain any sense of direction with this debate. Thank you, Ian. Appreciate that. John on Facebook got in touch to say, wow, the recent show on Logos and consciousness was riveting. I listened a while back to a show you aired on the idea of consciousness that hinted at panpsychism, and it got me to really question the Western idea of materialism and or dualism as to the relationship of mind, spirit and matter. It made me wonder about what Jesus said about the rocks crying out, or what Paul said about the creation groaning wasn't just a metaphor. Additionally, it reminded me of another guest who described the nature of evolution in having an ecological mind or consciousness in choosing adaptations. I kept wondering, though, if there were not a triune explanation of the nature of the universe that was mind, matter and energy, where each are interdependent and coalesce into what we know as reality, thereby reflecting the triune God who created it. Instead of arguing for a perspective that would have primacy, maybe the nature of reality is simply triune, interdependent and co-equal, just like God. Additionally, I found these quotes fascinating from your guests. The universe that exists is a local phenomenon within consciousness. That was David Bentley Hart. And Raymond saying, we agreed just enough to make our disagreements interesting. Also, the idea that Raymond mentioned that the light mentioned in the early part of Genesis in the creation story could perhaps be the blending of consciousness and matter was a sheer epiphany to me. My mind, pardon the pun, was blown. Thanks again for being awesome, Justin. Thank you. Glad you enjoyed it, John. Great to hear from you. And this one from Eric said, great show with David Bentley Hart and Raymond Tallis. I found this deep philosophical discussion about the Logos very interesting. I think the question for most people is, which religion best embraces the idea? I'd say that the Judeo-Christian tradition is unparalleled. In this regard, Genesis is absolutely unique as creation stories go. A thinking God spoke his mind, and God said, and filled the universe with good creational words, which he strung together into a very good ecological whole. Stunningly, he also created image bearers equipped with voice recognition software, able to comprehend what he had spoken. Thank you very much. Lots of interesting comments on that. So thank you very much. Also, some people getting in touch actually via the Unbelievable channels to talk about the N.T. Wright podcast. If you haven't yet started downloading that, if you're a podcaster and you enjoy theological discussion and thought, do so. The Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast, the most recent show was on women in leadership, which was a fascinating one because we got to open up all those passages around, you know, that apparently forbid women from preaching in church and that sort of thing. And Tom just had some really interesting insights into those. So that's at the AskNTWright.com website. You can start downloading the show, subscribe to a newsletter, which will also get you a fortnightly update on all things Tom Wright. So look out for that. Looking forward to hopefully arranging an unbelievable show with Tom in the not-too-distant future, though. Again, always fun to have him on the programme. Thank you very much for being in touch with all of your various emails, texts, tweets and Facebook comments. It's always great to hear what the unbelievable audience make of the show from week to week. I'm really looking forward to some future editions of the show. I'm going to be soon airing a debate between J.P. Moreland and Stephen Law on scientism. Is it the new religion? We'll be asking J.P. Moreland, one of the guests joining us for Unbelievable, the conference 2019 on Saturday the 20th of July in central London. Mark your diary and be there. It is the UK event for anyone interested in evangelism and apologetics. I'm really looking forward to revealing the full lineup and our theme for this year very soon as we open the ticketing very shortly. But next week on the show, let me tell you what's coming up then. You're unbelievable. I'm going to be sitting down to talk about whether abortion law has gone too far. Former Planned Parenthood employee Sue Tyer, now a part of the pro-life movement, will be debating Anne Furedi of the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, one of the key abortion providers here in the UK about the realities of abortion within the abortion clinics. So look out for that. That should be a gripping ethical debate on next week's show. For the moment, thank you very much for choosing Unbelievable today here on Premier Christian Radio. Don't forget to check us out online as well. Coming up next is The Profile with John Dixon, and I'll see you next week. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.